Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Mastering Dungeons, your favorite D&D RPG, two middle-aged dudes talking about stuff podcast. I'm here with Teos Abadia and I am Sean Merwin, and we are going to dig into it right away after I hear how you're doing, Teos.
I'm doing well. Mother's Day over the weekend. We did all kinds of fun hikes. I climbed really high in the Columbia Gorge and looked down upon everything. And, you know, it was pretty neat. It was empowering. It was fantastic. Yeah. Lovely.
How can you climb high into a gorge? Isn't a gorge down?
Indeed. But this was like the inside of a volcano that was left standing. And so we ascended that and looked down upon everything. Which gotcha. Reminds me, my wife found a website that I think it's just for the Columbia Gorge. I don't even know what I'm talking about. But this website, somebody took to doing reviews of all the various trails, but from a fantasy thing. So it's like, you know, pass the goblin cave, head up the thing, you know, cross by the stream, watch for the troll. I think that's great. That's like, okay. Hats off to that person.
Awesome. So you survived the goblin cave.
I did. And the Red Dragon lair and all of that. And yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you're probably second level by now then.
And about time.
So we need to get you right into your job here. As we first take our questions and comments from our listener corner. Thank you to those who talk to us via Patreon, Discord, or YouTube, or Mastodon, or Blue Sky, or the Flaming Hellscape that's Twitter, or in real life, or at conventions, or just in our fevered imaginations. Starting with Michael J. Pastor via YouTube, who asks, how is the return on investment risk and reward ratio in movies and studios similar to or different from game development? And Teos, you dug into this question a little bit, so I'm going to let you spill your guts here.
Yeah, I tried to do a little bit of research, and it looks like success rates of video games and movies are pretty similar, with about 2 out of 10 movie or video game releases making a profit. Production costs have soared, so in 2004, making a video game cost about $10 million on average to produce, another $10 million to market. And you had to have very high sales to break even. I found that in the 1990s, the average production budget was more like $3 million. So from 3 to 10 and you know, and then doubling for the marketing. One source said that 10% of video games create 90% of the revenue, and only 3% of video games sell more than 100,000 units. So that's kind of why you end up seeing things like subscriptions, DLC, monetization, right? You get a hit, you keep trying to then make up for the failure rate of all those other titles that don't do so well. So how does that compare to role-playing games? And it's really hard to tell, Sean. You know, because if you look at something like Wizards, my first thought was, well, gee, has any of their books not made a profit, right? Has any of them exceeded the costs of writing that book and printing? But then there's a lot more that makes it complicated. Like Wizards is doing things like creating a virtual tabletop. They bought D&D Beyond. They have this huge staff and they do all these kinds of initiatives. And so actually a lot of things probably don't make money. And then you have things like the Book of Many Things, which was a very expensive product to make. And they had to recall all of it. So that one was almost for sure a loss. I mean, I would be shocked if it wasn't. But many of them may be losses for particular reasons that just feel like financial gobbledygook to us. And then I looked at, well, Evil Hat shared numbers, and it was, you know, 100,000 profit on like a million in sales. And if you look at the size of the product catalog, that has to mean a lot of those aren't profitable. Steve Jackson Games reported $3 million in sales in 2023 and said it wasn't a profitable year. So there you have, you know, all this manufacturing and employment, all of that, all this munchkin and Car Wars and all that, and probably many of those were not profitable. So for the large industry, maybe it's even worse than video games. One thing for sure is that the video game hobby, when you get that payoff is enormous, right? Mm-hmm. And the payoff for RPG books don't seem to be that big. So it may feel like there's less to lose, and may even be that there's less to lose, but more to gain. It's an interesting comparison, right?
Yeah, you did the research. I only know some of the research I've done recently, which there was a, I don't know if I mentioned this, I'll mention it again. It was estimated on a one business site that role-playing games and the peripheral stuff that goes with them, minis and so on, made 1.5 billion in 2021, I think it was. And they're estimating that by 2028 that might reach 3 million or 3 billion. Monopoly Go on its own in 10 months made what was it? 2 billion. So one video digital game made more than all role-playing games revenue-wise, in a year. And so that shows you the scale that we're talking about when you discuss video games versus role-playing games.
And if you look at role-playing games historically, right, the way it used to be was you would a role-playing company would create a core book that would sell okay. You probably were profitable on that. And so you have some small amount of profit. You would then take that and reinvest that into or take out more loans, depending on how you run your business, to make a second book. But each book you release appeals to fewer people, right? Eventually you're doing the Book of Undead and someone's saying, oh, I don't like Undead. Or you're doing, Monster Book 2 and someone's saying, oh, I got plenty. And so your sales are just inevitably declining. And eventually you go bankrupt. And if you looked at the history of like beloved role-playing game companies, that's kind of what you saw was eventually they went bankrupt. So it's almost a sure thing to lose your shirt in the business, right? And it was a temporary thing. You worked on in a for a while and then you had to close that business down or change names or sell it off or something. So in some ways it's been a certainty of doing poorly until very recently where things like Kickstarter and better distribution models have changed things.
Totally. Next question comes from George PR via Mastodon. Design-wise, what are the trade-offs for a Vancian magic system versus a roll-to-cast system, i.e. Shadowdark versus D&D? Let's talk about what Vancian magic means. If you've been playing forever, you know this, but there are more and more newcomers coming into the industry. So the Vancian magic system is based on the fiction of, I always get this name wrong, because there's J.D. Vance, who is a right-wing politician.
Jack Vance.
Yes, Jack Vance wrote fiction, and some of his fiction inspired some of the rules of the original Dungeons and Dragons rules. So the Vancian system is, as a spellcaster, you have a certain number of spells that you can memorize. And so they're in your head, and after you cast them, that spell or that spell slot goes away until you take a long rest and rememorize those spells. So what the Vancian system is good at, and the reason it was used in the first place, is because it's both reliable and scalable. It's reliable because you know as the player exactly how many spells you can cast in whatever time period they refresh. And it's scalable because you can start out by being able to cast just a small number of spells. So your low-level character feels low level. And then that list, that number of spell slots can grow. So you feel very powerful at high level. Also, in its current incarnation for fifth edition and some of the previous editions, it's very flexible. So you can do different things with those spell slots. You can do many different things. You can focus on just certain things. And that way it's good. The original AD&D Vancian system was less flexible because you didn't just get spell slots that you could plug any spell into like we have now. You had to literally say, well, I have four first level spell slots for my character. So in those four slots, I will take two magic missiles, one detect magic and one sleep spell. And you couldn't switch them out, you couldn't change them. That's it. If you needed to cast magic missile and all you had left was sleep, then you had to do something else.
And for somebody like the
That's obviously,
cleric, that was tough,
yeah.
right? Because you're like, well, I have all these offense spells or utility spells, but boy, I need to heal people. So is it all healing? Like, how do I not just take all healing? And that was always a struggle.
Right. And over the editions, they changed that. They added cantrips that you could cast constantly. They added, for the cleric, they added something where you could take a spell that you had memorized and swap it out for a healing spell to give you more flexibility. So you didn't have to memorize healing spells. You could memorize the other kinds of spells, but always swap them out. And now we're to the point for 5e where it's the most flexible it's ever been. So
And you could
that's.
argue that we also sort of don't run out of spells, which is, a question, right? Is whether the balance of the game is about running out, or is it about always having these options, right? And at wills make you even more so you never run out, but that's changed too. And but that's nice. The Vanting system lets you do that. If you want your edition to be one where you seldom run out, well, then you can allot that in a based on the expectation of the adventuring day and so on.
So we're currently in the time of a, let's say, a modified Vanthian system. The roll to cast system like they have in Shadowdark, is interesting and it's more chaotic. It gives a different version of what magic is. So in that sort of system, you always have a spell until you don't. And I wouldn't compare Shadowdark to D&D in a way to show the strengths of different systems, because that is a very specific system that's built for a very specific play style and purpose, right? It's supposed to be chaotic and potentially dangerous and leave you with nothing at some point. Other systems don't often give you that flexibility, but the changes to the D&D system over the years sort of shows the evolving ethos of role players, what role players want in their games, to have that flexibility, to have more options. To have those things.
And maybe
So,
that's part of what, because Shadowdark is sort of saying, hey, your torch is going to run out, you're going to eventually retreat. Then if you run out of spells, it's not the end of the world. Though I certainly found in my play, and others have as well, that, in Shadowdark as a spellcaster, you have a game one time where your spells don't run out and you're just shooting away stuff. It's incredible. And then you have others where literally you fail every roll. And so that's, a question of how you want to do that. And other games do it differently, right? Like you have Arcanus Second Edition, I recall, where you have this initiative clock, where doing something like throwing a dagger means you'll go again very quickly, right? It's not strict rounds; it's like a count, and think of it as a number of segments you used up in time. So you go, oh, okay, I will go like in another, I'm going to make this up, 6 segments. But if you cast a spell, you may not go for what feels like a round and a half. Because that's the sort of recharge rate of the time it takes up to have done that. And so that is a different way to moderate how you're doing. And all of these systems need to think of how does this fit into the adventuring day? How does this fit into the number and typical combats that you're going to have? Is this supposed to emulate resource management? And what's the equity with the non-spellslinger, right? How do you achieve
That's
that? And that's, whew.
yeah. So all of those questions go into what sort of magic system you want to use. And that last one, I think, is the most important point, which is how is the spellcaster, we'll say the wizard in this case, supposed to feel compared to the fighter? In AD&D, it was at low levels, they were much weaker. And at high levels, wizards were much more powerful because their spells could do so much more, but they had a limited number, supposedly. And resource management was a much bigger part of the game. So that was a balance between classes over 20 levels, as opposed to a balance just at a snapshot in time and of level.
And then 4E and Daggerheart say, well, what if I give you these cards that represent things like spells, but also other types of actions? And so I kind of smooth that out to we're all using a similar engine with which to say, do heroic stuff, right? And so you're just doing heroic stuff. Is it a spell? Is it a stab, a mighty stab, a leap and a parry, whatever it is, we're gonna have a different system for that and create its own balance through that.
So excellent questions. And thank you. And you could always send in your questions via all of the avenues that I mentioned previously. Jumping into our news and commentary, we'll start right away by saying that the D&D 5.2 SRD is coming February of 2025. So it's not going to be very long before after the core books come out that we see this SRD.
Yeah, and I
Your
thought that was interesting. They noted that it took 2 years for the 2014 rules to see an SRD, right? So they almost said, like, hey, you know how we took a while last time? We're ahead of the game now. Hey, yeah, true. And kudos, because a lot of us were worried that last time it took 2 years after publication, what's it going to be like? And now they're saying, well, it'll come out probably mid-February, mid to late February, after the MM is released, because they expect that that will have enough important content in it that you need to have the 5.2 SRD cover those changes. And I'm glad to hear kind of the tone of the article, because one of my worries is that they would maybe just address a few things if they even did have an SRD, that it would be more like a comparison document or something like that, but that it wouldn't be thinking through, hey, if we want creators to be creating for our game, how do we empower them to understand this? And they said the creators will have the tools they need to create content using the revised and expanded rule set. It will not, however, include the war lore references, DM's Guild for that. 5.1 will, of course, continue to be available. All of this is in the Creative Commons, so you can't not make it available. And they did say that if you wanted to create a subclass, for example, balancing it would require you to understand not only how classes have changed in the 2024 Player's Handbook, but how monsters may have changed in the 2025 Monster Manual, which is interesting. The idea that they're thinking that these changes have impacts, but it's all fully compatible. And if you wanted to create a campaign setting, having information from all three core rulebooks would be important. So that's why we're waiting till it's all together. They will be localizing in each language. For that each language that they support in the 2024 books. So that's not entirely clear, but maybe it's the same list of languages. We'll find out. And what else, Sean? They said something about older editions.
Yeah, it sounds like that you will be able to continue to use 5.1 that we know. They still need time, they say, to review older editions, so fourth edition, third edition, et cetera, but they still plan on doing so. It just won't be immediately.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I kept thinking they would drop that goal of doing previous editions, but they apparently say they'll still work on it. I mean, they always say that, well, we've got to, make sure that we don't use lore we shouldn't, but that shouldn't be really that hard. Like, I think I could do that in an evening, but okay. But we'll see. We'll see
Well,
when that comes out.
the speed with which they're doing this and the speed at which they announce this tells me that it's important to them,
Yeah, that's
right?
true.
If you're super busy, you do the thing that's most important to you. And so this shows me that this is important both for PR purposes, but also for their business model going forward. So we have news later that sort of speaks to that, but we'll get to that in a second, because the other news that just dropped before we restarted recording, yay for waiting a day, is that the 2024 Player's Handbook cover is being shown. Game Informer had an exclusive look at the cover art for the 2024 Player's Handbook. It features the some adventures from D&D lore. Strongheart, Elkhorn, Merkion, and others who were action figures in the 80s who represent various species and classes. They're with a gold dragon behind them and a red dragon, they are battling in the foreground. And then draconic creatures, maybe kobolds, approach from one side with the characters standing on a bridge. This is art by Tyler Jacobson. Other pieces by Tyler were also shared. Art revisiting the D&D cartoon characters as they explore a jungle temple. Other art shows different characters on the back of a gold dragon. And then the previously seen art by other artists were also shared. What else, Teos?
Well, I dig this. At first, I thought like, oh, they're going back to the cartoon, and all I really want is the actual cartoon, not art based on the cartoon. But then I thought, you know, this is 50-year edition. And so that does make sense to have these kinds of callbacks. Like, that is kind of smart. In fact, I hope that we find some art that shows like Miley and Tordek and all those guys. Like, I want to see, you know, a bunch of them show up too, like the iconic characters from third edition and some of the pre-gens from AD&D days. You know, I hope we see more of that in the art, because that would actually be really clever to sort of speak to that and have almost like Easter eggs. I think that'd be pretty enjoyable. The article says that pre-orders start on June 18th. We are again told that the books, the biggest books ever, they have 384 pages. And that actually is a different number of pages than we've heard before. And that is an actual longer, it's a higher number of pages than in the past. And let's see, one of our friends was saying that the Player's Handbook currently for 5th edition has 320 pages for both Player's Handbook and DMG, and 352 for the MM. So 384 is more, but we know that there's also more art in these books than before and larger font. So probably it's not more words, or it's at least really, really close. But we'll have to wait till we have it in our hands to know for sure.
Not surprising. They get to say there's more pages, and they get to add more art, which some people love. And so great. I could care less how many pages is in the book, to be honest. I could
That's
care
fair.
less about the art,
Yeah.
but that's just me, as long as the game plays well. I know. I'm just not a visual person.
How
That's all I
dare
can
you? Oh
say.
my God. I see, more and more when I hold a book, like I'm got this puppy that I picked up at my local gaming store, the Vecna special edition cover. It's holding it in my hands that makes this a pleasurable read. Like, when I started reading it on D&D Beyond, I was like, man, yeah, whatever. And then I was like, all right, let's sit down and read this. And physical book in my hand, I'm loving the first chapter, really enjoyed it. And I don't think I would have had the same experience on D&D Beyond. So there we go. You and I are not the same, apparently.
It's true. Just announced, this isn't even in our show notes. Wizards is partnering with Dead by Daylight, a video game where one player plays a killer and up to four other players play the survivors, and they chase each other around this video game and try to escape. And it's been around for a few years now, this video game. They've partnered with other folks, but they are going to have a D&D version, and we saw just today that the killer, at least in this little
Trailer.
promo,
Yeah.
is Vecna.
That's really cool. Yeah, it's neat. The trailer's pretty nice. It does a very the graphics are great. It looks all very D&D themed. Vecna looks awesome. The adventurer reaches into a chest and finds Vecna's hand, and I guess then Vecna decides that they want it back.
So, if you have played that game, now you can play a D&D version. Or if you've never played the game and you love all things D&D, you can check it out. Switching over from D&D to Critical Role, Critical Role has launched a Beacon subscription service. What does this mean? It is a service that offers ad-free shows spanning everything that Critical Role has provided in the past. The podcast will still be available, or the podcast will be available immediately after the initial show. Then it gives you early access to shows, some exclusive content, such as post-show reactions, Q&A sessions with the cast and crew, event pre-sales, 10% discounts on merchandise, a private Discord you can access, and the content will still be on the usual platforms as well. You
Yeah,
can
really
find this
cool.
by going to critroll.com/beacon.
It'll be really interesting to see. It's almost like a full circle thing from the Geek and Sundry days to now this Beacon subscription service. You know, they work hard. I wish them great success with this, and hopefully it does draw in a lot of fans. It'll be interesting to see kind of, you know, a few years from now whether this is going strong and you know what that looks like.
We had a great conversation about this last night on the Eldritch Lorecast because James Hake interned for Geek and Sundry,
Right.
and Dale Kingsmill was on Geek and Sundry, and their time didn't overlap there, but they actually it was sort of continuous. One left when the other showed up, and not because of each other, just in, that's how it
I
happened.
mean, James shows up,
I
gotta
would
get
leave
out of
too.
there. No.
No. And so they had a really great conversation about lots of this stuff, what's come before for Critical Role and Geek and Sundry in terms of
I'll check that out.
subscription services. Great conversation. So you can check that out on this week's episode. D&D at Gen Con. Sometimes we don't know what's going on with D&D at Gen Con until a week before the show.
Yep, like
Sometimes it's 2 weeks
last
before the show. Sometimes it's a month before the show, but it's generally after tickets have already been on sale for a while. Well, D&D has its stuff together this year because it has already been announced 3 months before the show about what D&D is doing at Gen Con. Gen Con is August 1st through 4th in Indianapolis, and event registrations opens May 19th at noon Eastern Time.
All
So
right.
you can buy your tickets for all of these things very, very soon. What's going to be there? I'll start. D&D Live, star-studded cast, a fun night including food, drink, and surprises. More details will be shared about this in July.
Ooh, you know what that means?
What?
All the people who do those thumbnails of D&D is on fire, it's the worst thing ever, I hate them. We'll have one positive video for the night that they attend this.
That's true. That's true.
Couldn't
Yes.
help it,
D&D is
sorry.
terrible. Wait, I was invited to a exclusive show. D&D is awesome tonight. Okay, now back to how terrible it is. You want to know everything about the 2024 Players Handbook? Well, there's a panel for you. A look at the book with the designers, insights on the design process, and how community feedback has shaped the product. A panel on D&D Beyond's partners. It's the D&D Beyond Partner Spotlight that talks all about partners and partnering with D&D Beyond, what has been and what shall come. The 2024 Dungeon Master's Guide Tips and Tricks. The quote here is the 2024 Dungeon Master's Guide offers expanded advice and guidance for DMs of all skill levels. The D&D team shares their favorite tips and tricks from this upcoming book. You want to know about D&D's digital tabletop future? Well, there's a panel for that. A partner panel on multiverses and cocktails, new books from 10 Speed Press, which is just about this cocktail book. It gets its very own panel. So if you're very thirsty, you can go there.
So partner panel. I wonder how, I wonder what, I'd like to know how that all came to be. That somehow this one group that lands these cookbooks and cocktail books and that lore book that was not that great. That someone has an in there, right? That manages like we're gonna put all the D&D partners for D&D Beyond partners in one meeting. But then we're going to give a singular panel to this one group for a cocktail book. That's interesting.
Either someone is married to or related to someone, or money talks.
I mean, we did
One.
see in the book scan sales data that cookbook did sell a lot. So maybe
Yep.
that's all that that is. But
There you go.
yeah, a little surprise. Okay.
You want to get your book signed by D&D designers? There will be D&D designer signings. And then there are some special play events. The most, prominent one is the 2024 D&D Open. The competitive D&D event returns. Yolande, the Elf Queen of Selene, calls for your aid to thwart a new evil presence that has taken root near an infamous old site. Level 4 characters will be provided, built with the rules from the 2024 Player's Handbook. This is a tournament event that takes place over 3 sessions on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Unlike D&D tournaments of old, all teams will play all 3 sessions and are scored on each session, and prizes will be awarded on Sunday for the top teams.
So
So you want
whenever.
to play a little competitive D&D? We got you covered.
So I
And
think,
that, oh,
as you
go
say, I
ahead.
think my understanding is that the D&D Open was written by staff this year. I think.
Could be.
And if that's the case, then I'm doubly curious why they picked a Greyhawk location. Start your rumor mongering now.
There you go. I don't know who wrote it. I know who did not write it. And that's me.
True.
And if you want regular D&D play, Bald Man Games is there running all sorts of D&D, everything from a new learn to play demo in the convention center to more games at the JW Marriott. All the Adventures League content and other Bald Man Games content. You can sign up to run games at baldmangames.com/GenCon-2024.
Get a free
And
badge.
may I say that you can also sign up to run Ghostfire Gaming events through Bald Man Games. Ghostfire Gaming is running a Grim Hollow adventure on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And then you can take those pre-generated characters to an epic that's playing twice on Sunday.
Ooh, that's fun. I would
So
love to be there. I don't think I will be.
there. Okay.
Wish I could.
Well, we wish you could be there, Teos, if possible. And as always, there's more information to come, and all of that can be found on D&D Beyond through a link in our show notes. Speaking of Wizards of the Coast and DMs Guild partners, MCDM's Flea Mortals is now available on D&D Beyond,
Wow.
along with their adventure lair book, Where Evil Lives. You get all the great Flea Mortals monsters for $39.99. You can pre-order Where Evil Lives for $29.99. Or you can get them both together for $59.99 and save $10. That's great. More content for all the gamers on D&D Beyond. And can we stop talking about the OGL fiasco now?
No, Sean, never.
Not ever.
No, the anger is deep. I was just checking the anger level yesterday on a Discord channel, and it's still very high. There's a lot of
It's
anger.
still, yeah.
Now, well, I mean,
It's
this is
just.
fascinating, right? Because Matt Colville, who is the main person at Flea Mortals, he will speak unabashedly about how little he likes Wizards of the Coast and liked working there when he did and all that. And so it is kind of funny, and I did check to see whether the videos that involved D&D announcing this included James or Matt, and they certainly included James. It is fascinating, and on one hand it makes total sense, right? Because when you think of like the list of like really great D&D 5e compatible material that comes from other parties, you can't not think of Flea Mortals and Where Evil Lives. Really well-run project, a lot of fun. Great to see it on D&D Beyond. But also, these are, just like with Kobold Press, companies that have had strained relationships at time. And what does this all mean? And when I think about some of the things that we talked about earlier, I think to myself, like, say why is the SRD important? I give it some non-zero chance that D&D is considering a world where it's almost like the third edition plan that was never adopted. But what if you did make core books and have other companies do all the other stuff for you, but then derive profit from that? And I wonder if there's someone toying with that idea. There's a non-zero chance of that. And I think it's really fascinating to see more and more third-party products. We'll see.
Yeah,
I'm keeping an eye
I
on
think
this.
it's much greater than a non-zero chance. And I think it comes with the growth of the industry. I think there probably was a mindset within the D&D design team that they were the only ones who could make stuff.
Sure.
And that other people either were not skilled enough or might have been close to skilled enough, but did not have the inside knowledge that design team had about direction of the game. And after I posit, after successful interactions with third-party companies that proved that not only were their design chops good enough, but were sometimes even on par with or beyond the skill of the people designing within the Wizards of the Coast studio, that it is now a safer bet to reach out and tap those resources to provide content to the industry, to the audience as a whole.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think you have to go back and know the unknown things we can't know, which are what is the profit like on a book, and the what can the staff do versus not do, and when you want to increase your revenue, does this make a lot of sense? But I do think that there have been one of the criticisms I have of that third edition model of like, what if we only make three core books and then everybody else makes stuff for us, is that you do, I think, lose a little control of steering the ship, steering the brand. But that can happen even when you have it as well. So
I
yeah,
was
maybe it isn't such a big loss, right? But it's a
just going
tough
to say
choice.
that.
And I think that if I worked there, it would be very difficult for me to want to sign off on that kind of an approach. I would probably be the person in the room advocating against it, because I would worry that even when we're inefficient, if you give up understanding who you are, then other people are declaring that for you. And that's a tough place to be in, and that you'll probably down the road find that you wish you had been in charge of something that someone else got to dictate those terms, right? Of how the industry responds, of how the growth is, of what kind of stories are told, of where the game evolves. Like at some point, you're no longer the main person doing that. That's a little dangerous, but.
Yeah, if a growing segment of your audience considers you evil and the man and a thing to be fought against, even if you do have a clear vision of what you want, and even if that vision is great, it is going to meet resistance. Whereas letting go of some of that, putting the power to not just create the stuff, but market the stuff and engage with the audience in other people's hands frees you from that burden.
I mean, I don't think that people, like, I know that the online communities we all frequent, for sure, you see that everywhere, but I don't know that that's really how the hobby as a whole or the greater populace sees Wizards. I think those folks, I mean, just, I've talked about the conventions I've worked, signing up all these new players to try D&D. Like, two people mentioned the OGL out of all of that, right? And in like an angry way, like, man, I'm not playing that game. I hate Wizards. Then you got thousands otherwise, right? Like, I
Right.
don't.
But you are absolutely correct. But who does Wizards sell their core books and their pencil cases and their video games to? They sell them to those people. Who buys the adventure modules and the 2 years later box sets? That's the more engaged folks that are that way. So then you can offload some of
Reasonable.
that, onto people who are more engaged with those niche communities.
Maybe. I mean, I think that's totally possible, right? Like I can't counter that. I can't argue against that. That's entirely plausible. I think it also is just as likely that internally they're saying, well, what if we focus on a virtual tabletop and we f focus on D&D Beyond subscriptions, and maybe that's where we should be focusing. I don't know.
Yeah, what if we
Perilous.
focus on partnering with digital game providers
Right.
and cookbooks, and what if we put more of our focus in that direction?
I mean, and that's fine, but it also creates a position where if you think of the core of D&D as suddenly being like a partner thing rather than your own thing, you may value it less, especially when, as we said at the start of the show, Monopoly Go can generate so much more income. So just do that sort of stuff. And yeah, it's
You may value it less And that can be bad, but it also can be okay if it does have less value.
If it can still grow. Yeah. If it can still
Right.
do what it needs to do for us. Yeah.
For sure.
Oh, it's fascinating. Yeah.
Yep. Good discussion. Also under discussion is the free Vecna wallpaper and the Nest of Evil news. D&D Beyond provided a message from Vecna recently suggesting to look for secrets. And there is a spoiler if you need some help doing that. Teos, what do you have on this?
Yeah, bottom line is once you figure it out or click on the spoiler, you can get yourself a download of the wallpaper art for the free for the Vecna book. And if you, in related news, if you felt bad about that prequel Nest of the Eldritch Eye and how you couldn't get it because you didn't pre-order, or maybe you pre-ordered solely because that was the only way to get that, well, turns out that a recent article that talks all about how DMs can run Eve of Ruin, the actual D&D Vecna adventure, which I'm holding right here. Well, it at the bottom has wording that Welsh DM pointed out to us. Thank you. That says that the Nest of the Eldritch Eye prequel can be purchased separately after Eve of Ruin drops on May 21st. Is that a bait and switch? I don't know. I am glad to see it available for everyone. I think that should have been the plan all along. Get it free if you pre-order, but later you can buy it. That's fine, right? I don't think there's any reason why folks shouldn't be able to access that adventure, and I don't want to see things sort of locked up in weird ways. So I am glad actually to see that it can be purchased by the people who want it.
There you go. Speaking about being locked up in weird ways, if the current Open Gaming license and SRD for 5th edition isn't quite your cup of tea, you have an alternative. You have the Black Flag reference document. Kobold Press's system behind the Tales of the Valiant role-playing game. It uses the ORC, the Orc license. The Orc license is a little bit more complicated than just a plain old Creative Commons license, but it's still there available for you. It has all the bells and whistles that the 5e Open Gaming License and SRD have, and it's available to you to use to publish your content.
Yeah, and I just saw that today they Kobold Press has an article on how to use this SRD, which doesn't super answer everything. Like one of the things I was curious about is can I say compliant with Tales of the Valiant? Or do I need to say or compatible? Or do I have to say compatible with Black Flag? Like are those things, equal terms that I can use? It's also, Orc has certain stipulations around mechanics, so creators need to be careful about that because you have to use the Orc license, which makes you part of that Orc ecosystem that then anyone can take your mechanics. But maybe you felt that's the truth anyway, so that's okay if you do. But if you don't, certainly it's interesting to see that Kobold Press isn't putting all of their mechanics into this, so, do with that what you may, but it's cool. It's more options for creators, and I'm all about that.
There you go. Now let's get to our creator corner, starting with the digital deck of player safety being available via Demiplane. Tom Nelson, a friend of the show and Patreon backer, has created a deck of player safety. We've talked about it on the show a few times. That deck of player safety has been ported into a digital version usable on Demiplane. So the what is this is it's a deck of cards that you can pass around to your players who can then pick cards out for topics they may not want to discuss, topics that may trigger them, etc. And so they can anonymously give those cards to you. There's also blank cards. So if nothing bothers you, if nothing in the deck is anything that you need the game master to understand, you can just choose a blank card. Then everyone can give cards to the game master who can look at the cards and realize, okay, arachnophobia is one of the issues at the table, so I will change these spiders into wasps or whatever you choose to do. This can now be done in the digital version via Demiplane. So kudos to Tom, kudos to Adam Bradford and the folks at Demiplane for putting this safety tool and this session zero tool into digital format on Demiplane. We will continue because I know you want to talk about the next thing, which
I
is
do.
13th Age Second Edition coming to Kickstarter.
I'm super excited. I backed this. It took, milliseconds for me to back this after it released. So this is, as they say, the tabletop RPG incorporating the best parts of D20 rolling fantasy gaming with story-focused rules gets refreshed and modernized. And I had to immediately love that the Kickstarter page, if you read it, just like the 13th Age books, has commentary, where Rob Hiensu has comment, like takes what is written in the marketing text and goes, what's really going on here is, and adds his own kind of behind the scenes looks. And I think that's just great. So there are revisions to all class powers, easier to use icon rules. It sounds like it'll be easier to use icons in kind of really cool ways. And I'm looking forward to rating that for ideas on how to run factions. Revitalize monsters, more input unpredictability to increase GM fun. It's all compatible with the 1E books you own, so you can mix and match from any book. Rewards include the two core books, GM screen, a really big icon die, or an icon die, a cool velvet map of the Dragon Empire, and a really big escalation die, so you can show those turn orders. And a lot of folks have rated the giant escalation die to use in other RPG systems. So you can get a free preview by going to palgrainpress.com/13th-age-preview-pdf, link in our show notes, or through the Kickstarter itself, look for 13th Age. Really excited about that.
As of recording, it is at $295,000 with 3 weeks left to go. Next is Dave Clark doing a blog post on rethinking alignment. Dave is over at fullmoonstorytelling.com, and he points out that when using the bonds, flaws, and ideals and traits for 5e, each has many words that make it all very hard to remember. So what he suggests is replacing a system with four words that have general meanings behind them. So the acolyte background comes with personality traits that can really be summarized with faithful. Others might be termed suspicious or orderly or erudite. So those four words are then easier to recall for everyone at the table, including the game master, than a long, drawn-out sentence. Dave uses examples from novels and TV to capture personalities of characters with just those three to four words.
Yeah, great
And
read.
link
I
in our show
enjoyed
notes.
taking a look at it. And we've mentioned Dave before because he's often tracking the fate of the D&D movie, which was in the top 10 global views at one point last week, though no longer is in the top 10 in the US, but it has been there for an incredibly long time, more than a year. And yeah, it's a neat article. Check it out for sure.
A new game is on Backerkit called the Distal D20. Distal is a D20 fantasy role-playing game where the battles scar you, your decisions define you, and each triumph is earned. If you love building characters you can get attached to, or you are a GM wanting more meaningful stakes at the table, then you should check out Distal. You can get the free core rules document at the Backerkit, as well as a kit. Quick start set and a beginner adventure. Michael Henderson is behind this. He's better known as Rel, WRELL on YouTube and elsewhere. He was kind enough to have me on his show recently to talk about some game design questions. And so I am now taking an interest in the project that he's working on. And this one is out there. You can check it out at Backerkit. And what's this last thing about Kickstarter, Teos?
I'll try to go through this quickly. So much news today. Kickstarter had a creative download. They posted an article with trends in games. The top 10 in games start with a BattleTech game raising 7.5 million, and the list of top 10 has three RPG projects: Ryoko's Guide to the Yokai Realms, Crooked Moon Folk Horror, and Obojima Tales from the Tall Grass, all of which are for 5e. It tells you something. 65% of games projects met their funding goal. They say plus 17% year-over-year growth in the number of successful projects and 14% year-over-year growth in the number of games projects. So more projects, more successful projects. Something they didn't cover here, and we've talked about previously, is data is also showing less revenue per project, right? So there's kind of more competition out there. They point out that games based on established IPs have risen. They mentioned the 2021 Avatar RPG, but also other game materials from Marvel and things like that. When they look at 2024 as their look ahead, they don't really say much. They cite the D&D movie as sparking interest, but don't otherwise address RPGs or set any growth expectations. So we'll have to wait and see what happens there.
Right. In our main segment today here on Mastering Dungeons, we are going to continue looking at the playtest version of the critical role role-playing game called Daggerheart.
We're
four. Yes, you're stabbing your heart with a pencil heart.
Oh, air dagger.
Yep. Before we get into this section, which will include running adventures and game mastering tips, we are going to look at version 1.4 changes. It came out on the 7th of this month. Important notes: advantage has changed back to a D6. Rather than rolling an extra D12. That made sense to me for reasons that we discussed.
Yep.
Ancestries now have two features, whereas before I believe they only had one.
Mm-hmm.
Thresholds have been adjusted. I don't quite know what that means at this point.
So that's the damage level at which point you take a certain amount of, you know.
Damage thresholds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there were some classes that were sort of able to be like, yeah, you know, that doesn't, I'm never taking a major wound or anything like that because they were just too good.
Okay. And then the classes and equipment have been rebalanced along with lots of monster reworks. So we will be continuing our look by keeping as up to date as possible with the versions. But what we are going to talk about now is the running and adventure section and the things that follow. So now we're talking about the game masters. And they break down running and adventure into three categories: game master principles, game master best practices, and then pitfalls to avoid, as opposed to those pitfalls that you seek out and hurl yourself into.
And I gotta say, Sean, I'm really excited about this. What we're going to talk about, because when I first looked at like the outline of this, I was like, oh yeah, you know, this is that part where they tell you to like lean into the story and they're going to tell me to like, you know, don't require a role when you don't need one and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But as I started reading this, I actually really like how all of this is written. And I found myself thinking that finally, this is the part of the playtest packet where I go, yep, this is a critical role game. And that if I'm the critical role audience and I want to have these like big dramatic swings and like lean into the characters, the stuff I see, you know, that he is doing when he runs the game or any of the DMs they have are running the games. This was the part where I finally went, yep, this is the instruction I need to make the game not just be mechanically interesting, but feel like a critical role game. And so I actually really, I ate this up with a spoon. Yum, 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 yum.
Yeah. And this is important too, because as we've discussed before, the mechanics of the game require the game master to be very much in tune with everything we're about to discuss.
Yeah.
This is a game where if you have a subpar game master, you are going to have a definite subpar experience. Mm. As opposed to some games, including 5th edition D&D for me, where a subpar game master can still deliver an okay experience because it is a system that is so smooth, it is so self-aware and self-running that you could basically run a GM-less game of 5th edition if you wanted to. It would be combat-heavy,
right?
But you could do it.
Sure. Yeah.
This game, Daggerheart, is not at all a game where you could run a GM-less version
of
this.
And that's interesting because I thought of it a little differently, though I totally see how you feel that way. My impression was Daggerheart has said it's a narrative game, but then this mechanics section has so many meaty mechanical options that it feels like it's telling me otherwise. And it was getting this advice in this section that made me think, okay, now I see how you really meant to do this and how this can actually be that. And it's written in a way that I find really evocative. Like, I don't know, who was involved in writing this section, or maybe it's multiple people, but this feels really good. Like, it's good advice for any game, but it's particularly towards this game. And I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I say this with no sarcasm whatsoever. Who was heavily involved in writing this was Adam Coble and Jason Morningstar, who wrote Dungeon World. I think they were the two that wrote Dungeon World, because a lot of this comes straight from, if in spirit, if not in
It's
actual
not an actual,
words, a Powered by the Apocalypse type games.
So yeah, but I think in a little more, I don't want to say tangible way, maybe that's not the right wording. I feel that way about 13th Age too. I think other games have written sections like this. I just find it's particularly well done here. And it feels relevant to the particular system. Whereas sometimes when I read the things that, and I could be mixing whether it's Apocalypse World or Dungeon World or what, which one of these, but I felt like it's really good discussion that doesn't completely link up to the game itself. And I almost need to see how the DM runs it to understand how they're doing that with the game. Here, this made a lot of sense to me, but we should get into it and we'll see what.
No, I want to agree with you. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
This is using these sort of tried and true terms and concepts, but yes, tying them more directly to the system they're creating. This is like what D&D writing fails to do, which is, oh, make sure you can use advantage to,
Right.
reward people, but they don't say what advantage actually does. And
Yeah.
this goes to, it takes that next step that's needed, which is why I want to really focus in on it. So
Yep.
let's talk about each of
Agreed.
these things. GM principles, what do they give? They say begin and end with the fiction. The fiction drives play, and the point is creating a great story with your players. Very important, because the game asks the game master to keep coming back to the story. Keep coming back to what do the characters do, and what should be your response to that fictionally. If the player turns his back on the dragon, what should the dragon do? The rules might not say, oh, the dragon bites you if you turn your back on it, but the fiction says that's what the dragon would do because, foolish player, you just turned your back on him.
And there's a difference here, not only just in this paragraph, but in other parts later that talk about these kinds of topics, that I found myself comparing it to when we learned Shadowdark, which had really great guidance for GMs and how to interact with the players. If you look at those differences, it's very interesting what this is trying to do to say not just like that what the players decide matters, but that there really should be this kind of collaboration, and the fiction is all around the story that's being woven together, right? In a way that goes beyond what Shadowdark is instructing us to do, and really resembles what you see in Critical Role, where it's things like where you kind of find yourself wondering, like, wow, the player seems to have so much relevance to this scene. Did they meet beforehand and establish you're from here, you know all these things? Or did they make that up on the spot because they're, improv actor people that can do this? But these parts kind of drive you to that kind of play and they kind of tell you how to go about it and then say, by the way, don't worry if you mess up. I'm getting my head ahead of myself, but that's really neat.
The second principle is fill the world with life, wonder, and danger. And this means drive the action, the adventure, the high fantasy. work off the characters' backgrounds and create connections to catch their interest and create the drama. So make their lives part of the world, make their wonderment part of the world, make the danger that they as heroes, but though they as individual characters feel danger for. Next is make every role carry weight. Now, this is good advice for pretty much any game to a point. So it says only ask for meaningful roles, provide information freely, and validate the PC skills. This way, roles are dramatic when you call for them. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw that, I thought, I think I was still not yet won over by reading this section. But it's around here that it started changing because it does really say things like, because it's easy to say this, right? Like only call for a role when needed. And you read someone's adventure for the system, and there are all kinds of roles for all sorts of junk. And it's like, none of this is particularly different. What makes this different for Daggerheart? And I think where it starts getting to is where it says, give information out all the time and validate what the PCs are choosing to do so that you can, so that everything, they might roll dice, they might not, but you are adding to the fiction and adding to the moment and also asking, as we'll see later, questions of the PCs so that you're all together building things. And then when roles matter, that part should be clear. And I think that's the key piece here is that you might roll sometimes, but you're using it as a way of distribute information and interact. But then there are roles, right? And those roles are big deals, and you are feeding off of them. And it gets into that hope and fear system where you can have complications or benefits. You're working off of that. And if you think of watching a Critical Role show or other shows by other folks too, where there are these kind of big dramatic swings, this kind of thing is what's starting to align with how you can get there.
And it's also important that every role carry weight because every role can give fear and hope. So just the act of rolling carries more weight in the mechanics of the game. So you want to make sure that you're not just rolling randomly and building up fear and hope for players, especially with the understanding as we know it, that you have a better chance of rolling hope than a fear. If you have advantage, very much better chance of rolling hope than fear. Collaborate at all times, especially in conflict. So the game master is not an adversary. Tell an amazing story together and be a fan of the players. That advice has been now around for 20 some years, and it's in true in practically every role-playing game out there, to keep in mind.
Yeah, but this next one is where I think we really get into things that are different. And then when you add it all together, you get that picture of what this game's trying to do for you. So it says, ask questions and incorporate the answers. And we're told to weave the characters into the story. And we can ask questions. There are a couple examples given to world build, right? So if we know that a character is from this town and we're going to go to a market, we can say, hey, has your character been to this market? Do they frequent this market? And if so, do you want to tell us some of your favorite sights and sounds? Right? To which is a little different than a lot of games that'll say, like, oh, you entered the tavern and you can ask the players to say, tell me what the tavern keeper is like. And I find a lot of players, when I run these kinds of games, the players don't want to do that because they're like, that's what I hired you for. That's why you're the DM. And you're breaking a wall where none of it makes sense because you're just asking me to make up the world when that's actually why I sat down, is for you to do that for me. But here it makes sense because what we're asking to do is to say, we are writing stories that lean into the characters. So therefore, a lot of times when we do things, it won't be like most D&D adventures where nothing has to do with the characters, right? An ancient temple that has nothing to do with your history or whatever, like a marketplace that's in a brand new land. Here we're saying the opposite. We're saying we're going to go to a marketplace that someone has a link to. So we can turn and say to them, tell us about some of your favorite stalls or when you visited here as a kid or whatever. And they can add to all this. And we're told to ask for more information on things that can dig kind of deep. Like, your character emotions, the reasoning, the interest, history, right? And I found myself totally, and I'm not even like, I don't watch that much Critical Role, like very few times, but I've certainly seen enough clips to think of many times in my mind immediately of how these players will say, like, you know, I used to come here as a kid. This means so much to me. And this is the kind of thing that enables that when you do this to the game, right?
Yeah. For me, this is the gate. This is the gate to tell me whether the players that I'm going to be playing with want Daggerheart or want D&D.
Yeah. If at least in this, ask, in this intended version of it, you can certainly play it from the mechanics, but yeah. Yeah.
But even then, no, I'm going to go even further. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say that if the players are not flexible enough to immerse themselves in the story and the character, then they are probably likely the players who are also not going to enjoy or stomach the lack of initiative and the more chaotic storytelling way that combat might run, right? Yeah. That player who turns their back on the dragon and I just react to it because the rules tell me if they do something that spawns a reaction, you take it.
Mm-hmm.
And that player who likes order, who likes things to know exactly what things are going to happen when, will be upset when I do that.
Right, right.
And so there is a player type that connects all of these things, the role playing with the mechanics, you know, true, with the story. And this is a question. Yeah. Tell me about this marketplace. True. I can tell so much about a player, how they react to that question.
Right. Oh yeah, for sure. But I will say that when I played the first adventure, I don't feel like the first adventure lean into what I'm hearing here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always important, right? You got to close that loop. It's one thing to tell me here that this is how you do that, but then if you give me a demo adventure that's just sort of like run around and stab stuff, I mean, it wasn't quite that way, but it's mostly that, then, well, that's not happening, right? And so what I would like to see, and I hope that the second adventure they're going to release, you know, which I'm going to play again, when I play it, I hope that it will say, hey, you should have some backstory links and things to feed off of, because otherwise I'm not really playtesting the game if this is the key to the game, right? Or one of the keys. Right.
I play tested the exact same adventure you did, and my game master, who was a experience powered by the apocalypse game master, everything was a question and a how do you feel and tell me about this. So
that's cool.
The adventures will have to do a really good job of supporting these game masters who may be coming in without the experience of doing things in this way.
Yeah, because I mean, that's how fourth edition ended up getting that reputation of being sort of cold, right? Mm-hmm. That somehow, like a dwarf that swings with their axe in second edition, time after time, this does the same thing. And that player that was somehow happy then plays fourth edition and says, all you do is, you know, use your same at will over and over again. When you have like also encounters and dailies, and they're really wild, interesting things being described on all those cards. But if you approach it as a kind of board game, card game type thing, well, then it is a very flat and actually boring experience. And all the character powers seem all the same. And I think Daggerheart could be the same, right? I use my domain card. Well, you have a domain card too, so this is all the same. But it's not if we lean into that fiction, if we lean into the emotion behind why I'm doing this, my history, all those things. If we're all at the table doing that, that's a whole nother kind of game, right?
Yep. I am designing a game in my head and I cannot do that right now. I have to do a podcast.
So I'm told.
Yes. Next, hold on gently. So what this means is improvisation isn't and never will be perfect. Mm-hmm. So you will be able to make corrections and smooth over rough spots. So just go with the flow, do what feels right in the moment. Worry about the consequences down the line because you have the flexibility to do so.
I mean, it's great advice. It's really cool. And this is the kind of stuff when you and I reviewed the player's handbook for 2014, there's kind of none, and the DMG as well, there's none of this type of guidance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if I had a wish for 2024, it would be that this kind of stuff would be in there. And I'm pretty sure it won't be. Not that it has to try to be this kind of game, don't get me wrong, but just that kind of like, those are really important things for, I think, for DMs to hear, right? That you don't have to achieve the perfection of Critical Role, and you can say a thing and then smooth it over or correct it. And that's all right. You know, like, yeah, well, I said they were, you know, that they are a criminal organization. It's really more of this kind of thing, right? And how to do that, right? Those are skills you gain over time, hopefully, but it can be a very long time frame, and you might not be around, or you might not stick around long enough if the game doesn't appeal to you because you feel like you're just making mistakes and don't know what to do about it.
The final tip here is play to find out what happens. So collaboration is what ties character stories together. Adjust scenes or throw out plans when it becomes appropriate. So don't try to force the story in a certain way, especially in light of the randomness of dice. Play to, just as if you were watching the movie yourself, as strange things happen, as strange choices are made, allow that to be and move forward from there.
I really loved reading this because I just finished writing a blog article, What Kind of DM Are You? And in that article, I said, you know, that there's this question you can ask yourself, you know, are you the kind of DM that surprises the players? And that's what you're always thinking about, like, how am I going to surprise them? And then there are DMs who are like, how will the players surprise me? And this is really suggesting you do that latter, right? That you are surprised by the players. You're setting things up in a loose way so that you will feed off of the things they're going to surprise you. And it talks a little bit about how to do that. And so don't prepare, and it speaks to this later as well, but don't prepare so that it's just this thing that the players are going to do A or B, but rather prepare so that they will shock you and you'll adapt and play off of that. And that's really a neat style of play.
So we've covered GM principles. Next is GM best practices. The first one is cultivate a curious table. Create a mystery and help players wonder about it. Throw out hooks that foster creativity and curiosity. Ask questions, trusting your players to provide details based on their character's backstory, knowledge, and interest.
That's really cool. Sounds awesome.
Yep. Gain your players' trust. Follow through on the promises that you make. Let player hunches be correct whenever you can. Believe them when they say an experience that they have is valid. You can create uncertainty. Did you want to give this example about the rogue?
Yeah, okay. I thought that was neat, right? The idea that the rogue would say, you know, hey, I want to use my experience because I'm a sailor, so I know all about ropes. Well, you know, is climbing rigging like climbing a wall? And so the question it says here is, will that be enough to scale up a siege tower while it's careening down a bumpy hill and on fire, right? And so you can create that uncertainty, but allow what the player wants to do and see how those dice kind of determine the action, right? And maybe you adjust the DC or you change, maybe you just say it's disadvantage, but in general, you should let players do the things they want to do for those reasons and believe them when they say it, even if you portray it as uncertain.
Next is treat the characters as competent. And this ties back to that roll only when there is dramatic reason to roll. Let the characters do the things that they are good at doing. No roles necessary. Give them the information they need to have fun with the game. Put them into trouble, but let them get out of the trouble that is easy to get out of, while the roles will tell about getting out of the trouble that's hard to get out of. Cut to the action. Use cutscenes, montages, and etc. to skip over the things that are more narrative based, when there isn't a lot of drama in them. You can also use flashbacks or let the players summarize their travel or their shopping spree or whatever else is part of the story, but not the focus of the story.
Yeah, they have some nice examples, both here and in another section about this idea of how you can do that and how you can summarize things. And it's a trick that, you know, we see this a lot written up in a lot of game master guides or RPGs, but I like how they do that here.
Keep the story moving forward. Any action rolls made can succeed or fail, but whether they succeed or fail, they should always keep the story moving forward. It's the sword fight scene in an old time pirate movie where 3 minutes pass and they're just still sword fighting, and nothing's really happening. Let make things happen as players succeed. Let things happen as players fail. Change the scene based on those. Help the players use the game. The game is a toolkit to help build a story together, not an obstacle to being happy or telling a story.
Yeah, it's neat.
Create a meta conversation. So use safety tools when applicable. Slip out of character if you need to clarify something that is a miscommunication on the meta level. Give out information about the world that the characters may not be interacting with at that point, but will act as important background information later that the player can then seep into their character's knowledge.
Yeah.
For me, that's a really important one because, as we've talked about with adventure design so many times, there's information that would be cool, that would add to the experience, but we too often hide it behind checks, history checks, or religion
Yeah.
checks, etc. Just get it out
Get it out
there,
there.
make it part of the story and part of the enjoyment of the game.
Yeah, and along those lines, they say ground the world in motive. Characters, and I like that they term them characters, not just non-player characters or monsters, but characters from an ambitious baroness to a swamp serpent are driven by motivations. So, you know, we're not just running goblins to be murderized. What are they doing here, right? What are their both, and this is consider both their short and long-term goals. And they say events hit harder if characters understand NPC motivations, and of course, if it links back to our overall fiction that we're doing. And what the backstory is of these characters, right? Then this all becomes really important. And if you think of Critical Role storylines, then this all registers as true, right?
This is, I will th I'm thinking of a dungeon world crocodile as a monster, right? You might think, what does that have to do with motivation? The dungeon world crocodile's motivation is to eat. It is to grab something and drag it underwater where it can eat it. That is a completely different encounter than a D&D alligator that comes out of the water and is a big bag of hit points that the players hit, or takes away characters' hit points and doesn't do anything except bite, maybe grapple, maybe tail slap. But as soon as you add that motivation, eat, that changes the encounter. Now
It
a
does.
success mo moves the story forward. It grabs your character and drags it underwater. Now what are you going to do? That's a story.
Yeah. And in that situation, it also frees us up that because of those motivations, and if the players all understand about this, they may react to it. And we could perhaps have this be a very significant foe that can't easily be defeated through combat. But you have to solve what to do about the situation, not just reduce the hit points to zero, right? And that's really neat.
And if you understand, as Teo says, if you understand that this crocodile's motivation is to eat, and they are in the swamp looking for a lost caravan, there's that aha moment when the alligator comes out. And if they understand that its motivation is not to kill everyone, but to eat one person,
Right,
they
get
can
a
then
meal.
say, ah, now we know where part of this caravan may be. Let's follow this alligator back to its lair as opposed to just killing it now. It adds to the depth of the story.
And I thought this was fun. If you know Critical Role, they will use Dwarven Forge and miniatures and things like that, which seems sometimes opposed to the idea of being so creative and into the drama of it. But it actually instruct us here, bring the game's mechanics to life, right? Use minis to show overwhelming phone numbers. Add a storm countdown to make sure players understand that this matters. Describe the risks and consequences of roles both before and after. I like that kind of advice. It's really nicely done.
Yeah, absolutely. And the describing the risks and the consequences of roles before or after is a great and powerful storytelling tool because it gets the characters and the players' minds not just on what did happen, but what could have happened. Yes, you can try this. If you succeed, you will do blank. But if you fail, you will be captured and thrown in the dungeon. Oh, you succeeded. Congratulations. You've moved on to the next step. There's always that alternative universe where they wonder what would have happened if we had been sent there?
Totally.
How would
Yeah.
the story have changed? So, what do we have next?
Reframe rather than reject is our next advice. And this is don't just say no. Understand the intent of the player or the character, and then reframe or work with them so there are options. And it gives some examples there as well. And I think that's a really nice way to handle this. So this comes up a lot, right? What do I do when my players want to, like Legolas does, right? I want to chuck my shield down and ride that down while making attacks. Well, in Daggerheart, where you aren't doing things in initiative, this becomes a lot more possible. And so that whole idea of, what is it this character is trying to do and how do I work with that to make big, bold, dramatic moments so that this is all fun for everybody. So the idea that it's not a yes, no answer. It's a figuring, thinking through what would make it awesome, why they're trying to do this, and then find a way to work with it.
Right. What we're talking about here is a writer's workshop, right? It's the writer's room for a TV show. It's, oh, my idea is this. Hey, that's a good idea, but for these couple of reasons, it might not be perfect. How about we add this? And you are turning your game table into a writer's room to come up with the story that pleases everyone rather than just the game master or one player.
Right. I think the example here is a player who wants to fly up to a platform using telekinesis. And they're like, well, what you could do is there are all these large rocks that you see here, and you could move those around with your telekinesis. It's like, okay, so maybe I can build, a pillar that lets me reach that or something, some other way of getting to the point of what I want, which is to get up to the platform. But it isn't turning telekinesis into fly, which is not what that spell or power is meant to do.
And what's the final one for our list of best practices?
Work in moments and montages. So if stakes are high, zoom in to work in moments. But if the stakes are lower or we would do better to summarize things, then we can zoom out and say, here's what happened over the course of days. And this links to our previous thing where we can empower the players to summarize or take an action, describe the actions that happened, interesting things that happened during a travel, something like that. But to understand that feeling of the pacing and what to move in and out of.
Absolutely. And that brings us to our third category, which is pitfalls to avoid. What you don't want to do is undermine the heroes. So you have to remember that even level one heroes in this game are skilled. So failure is not incompetence, it's just an environmental or unexpected circumstance that is something to be overcome later, not a failure.
Yeah, I was reading something recently. I can't remember where I heard or read this, but somebody was saying something along these lines where how often characters, when you tell players to sort of describe what they're doing, that when they fail, they will describe it as sort of comedy and stupidity, right? Like ineptitude, incompetence. instead of something about the situation. And that's where the DM can drive a bit to say, you know that you could have climbed this easily, but what happened was, and you give some explanation for how that happened. And especially with monster fights, right? That's where you can show that the skill of the monster is that, at the last minute it dodges your otherwise excellent blow and so on. That it's the fact that you're facing difficult situations and there are these other factors at play, not that you are somehow a fool.
And that only works if you don't make characters roll for things that they should be able to do with no problem.
right.
It's the James and Tricasso story of putting on your socks and failing to the point where the game ends and you are sockless. That all of that works together. Another pitfall to avoid: always telling the players what to roll. Give them the freedom to decide how to handle challenges and what to do to accomplish it. So rather than, calling for a check, ask the players, how do you handle this? After hearing their description, then you can decide if a check needs to be involved at all. So this gets around the whole issue of, a player making the perfect speech to get what they want, then rolling the persuasion check and getting a one and having it be awkward.
Yeah.
This is, tell me the speech. Oh, you don't even need to make a check for this.
Right.
It succeeds.
And also that idea of that, if the barbarian wants to use intimidation, but you say, well, that's a charisma-based skill, you're not very good at it, and the player rolls their eyes, or the priest that doesn't have a high end, so therefore doesn't know much about religion, right? Like those problems that happen in D&D games, because there's this shackling of the rules to certain logic bits that were done for these other reasons that are totally separate from the scene we're in, right? And so here it's this idea that if the player wants to try a different type of way to resolve this, whether it's with rolling or not rolling, lean into that, right? And help with that. Mm-hmm. And they don't quite say this, on the mechanical side, but I'd be curious to whether they would think that you can alter the DC based on what they do, right? We've seen other games that do that. If I say that it's DC 15 to, climb this wall, and you instead want to talk a creature into, letting you go on its back and go up or something, do you then change based on the situation? Or if you did some other way of climbing at the wall, right, would you, use intelligence, right? Would then that be a different, do you come up with a different DC? Probably, maybe, but they don't really address that, which I think might have been nice example-wise to think through.
Next is, don't let the scene drag.
Yeah, good advice.
If an action can be completed with a single roll, then let the action be completed with a single roll. There isn't a lot of drama in the wizard trying to, get a bit of information out of a library.
Yeah.
Unless that scene is going to be complicated and dramatized by other outside factors, then for sure go ahead. But if it's just, we need this information, okay, give me a knowledge roll, okay, yes, you find it.
Yeah, and interesting, the next piece of advice, don't use singular solutions. The GM's solution should not be the only one. Adjust if the characters have a good idea. And they give the example of puzzles where it can be super frustrating. And in fact, I was reading the Vecna adventure. It has a puzzle in there that I imagine will create some frustration at tables as they struggle to figure this out. And I was thinking, this is a great example where you could have a different, more open puzzle design that could allow for different solutions that would be rewarding to the characters. Because in some ways, the expectation is, especially in this particular one I'm talking about, you're going to solve this puzzle. So if we're taking it as a conclusion that you're going to solve this puzzle, because otherwise you can't escape, then maybe we should have a more open design here so that you come up with the cool way that you solve this. And there are lots of ways that it could work based on what you've picked up so far information wise. Right. So I thought that was a really good example.
Yeah. And the next one is sort of a tangent to that, which is over planning. rather than spending time on situations, complex situations that sort of lead the characters along a certain path, just set up a framework for the scenes that if the characters go off that path, you're able to still progress with the story beats that they're laying down rather than the story beats that you are trying to foist upon them, if you will.
Yeah,
And the
absolutely.
last, one is don't let fear go unused. So if you are gaining fear in a certain scene, they suggest that you use that fear immediately because if you hold on to it for too long, there's a disconnection between the story that caused the fear to be created and the story that you're telling in this new scene. So while it's okay to hold on to some to be useful, try to connect the fear that's generated by these roles within the scenes that they're used.
Yeah, and there's nice interplay here where they're saying, on one hand, don't hold it back so long that there's this disconnect, but also there are times when you don't want to just interrupt the flow of the action, oh, you rolled like in our playtest, right, where we're just trying it out and we hadn't read all this stuff, and the DM is just doing what it looks like they should do, which is, well, we keep failing or rolling with fear, then the DM goes again and again and again. And that's where a case where like give them a little momentum, so maybe save some of that fear just because you want to let them get some tactics going, get some momentum, and then you're gonna superpower a foe to make up for it and catch up after some turns have gone by. And
And
that's that
with
kind of,
that, oh, go ahead.
that's that kind of advice that I love about what they've done here. They have really said, what does a DM need to know to run this game well? And they've really, I mean, great vision for what DMs need to hear to lean into what this game's supposed to be, and really hats off to whoever wrote this.
Those pages do a great job, and other games do a good job. This does a really good job of expressing it in ways that the rules back up, and then giving examples to show what the advice means in actual play. So kudos to that. We have a lot more to talk about for this game, but we don't have a lot of time. So we are going to end there, and we are going to thank you, our listeners, for listening to the show. We hope you like what we're talking about. You should always feel free to give us feedback on what we're covering, how we're covering it. If you want something different, if you have a thought, please share it with us. You also can become a patron of the show, and we thank all our patrons. We thank our Master of Dungeon supporters. We thank our Master of Realm supporters with a shout out in our show notes. And we thank our Master of the Multiverse patrons right now, starting with Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing, Lou Anders of Lazy Wolf Studios, Craig Bailey, David Bastiansen, Steve Bissonette, Merrick Blackman, Evil John, Andy Edmonds at nerdronomicon.com, The Mighty Jerd, Ben Heisler and Paige Lightman, Sean Hurst, Brian King, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Chad Lynch, The Mathemagician, Eric Menge, John Mickey, Sean Molly, Falcon Neal, Tom Nelson, creator of the now digital deck of player safety, Mike Olson, Mighty Zeus, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Robert Pasley, Vladimir Prenner from Croatia, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, Ross Sandberg, Andy Shockney, Krishna Simonse, Jeremy Talloman from the D&D and TV podcast, Trace, Joe Tyler, Marcelo de Velasquez, the valiant DM. Thank you for your support. Sorry, I was surprised to see your name there. James Walton, Graham Ward, Javier Wasiak, and Chris Webster. Thank you so much for your support. And thank you to our listeners. If you like the show, you can become a Patreon by going to patreon.com/masteringdnd. Also, if you get a chance, leave us a review on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to this podcast. And also, you can just head on over to YouTube, click on the like and subscribe, and see our beautiful faces. Teos, where can people find your stuff?
Ooh, find me at alphastream.org. I've been releasing several videos. Today, I launched a new Success in RPGs video on how to become a successful freelancer. So you can get to that on YouTube, but you will find a link at alphastream.org.
And you can find me on Twitter at Sean Merwin, on all the socials at Sean Merwin. You can find the podcast on all the socials at MasteringD&D. Leave us comments, send us messages, send us DMs, whatever you need to do to connect with us. We are here and ready to listen. Also, go to youtube.com/@MasteringDungeons. So now we know everything we need to know about game mastering for Daggerheart, except the actual rules for game mastering, which we'll cover next time. So what are we going to do now?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think I'm going to go downstairs and prepare lunch with as much hope as possible and as little fear as possible.
I fear that you will use cutlery, so just be very careful, Teos. Although that would make a really excellent story.
Keep the fiction moving forward.
Mm-hmm, always.